Good afternoon, everyone. I hereby call this meeting to order. All the representatives of the commission are present. I'm Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis. I'm joined in person today by David Brownfield, Staff Counsel and Commissioner Alternate for State Controller Malia Cohen. We are also joined by Michelle Perot, representing the Department of Finance.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum present. In addition, I would like to identify members of the staff of the commission participating virtually for this hybrid meeting. We have Zoom co-host Mike Farina, speaker coordinators Jeff Plovnik and Katie Robinson-Phillip, and meeting liaison Kim Lunetta.
Thank you very much. For the benefit of those in the audience, the State Lands Commission manages state property interests in over 5 million acres of land, including mineral interests. The commission also has responsibility for the prevention of oil spills at marine oil terminals and offshore oil platforms and islands, and for preventing the introduction of marine invasive species into California's marine waters. Today, we will hear requests and presentations involving the lands and resources within the commission's jurisdiction. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge and express gratitude to the Nisenan, Wintun, Miwok, and Maidu people who have inhabited the Sacramento River corridor, valley, and foothills for countless generations. I'd also like to take a moment to honor the California Native American communities all across the state for persisting, carrying on diverse cultural and linguistic traditions, and sustainably managing the land that we now share. Native people have maintained a constant presence on the landscape for many thousands of years, and they are essential stewardship partners, whether along the coast, along our rivers and valleys, or in our fragile deserts. We thank California Native American communities for participating in this commission's activities and for their essential role in maintaining and adding to our state's rich cultural legacy. The next item of business will be public comment. Before I open the public comment period for items not on the agenda, let me first thank everyone, especially our stakeholders and members of the public, for taking the time to join our meeting. Now I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Cato to quickly share some instructions on how we can best participate in this meeting so that it runs as smoothly as possible.
Thank you, Chair Kounoulakis. There will be two public comment sessions. We will take public comment during the first session for a maximum of 30 minutes due to the extent of our meeting agenda. Please complete an electronic request to speak form that's available on our webpage. For both sessions, we will take those members of the public who are here in person first and hear comments from those members of the public who are participating virtually. We will call on you in the order in which you submitted the electronic request to speak form. For those participating virtually, please make sure you have your microphones or phones muted to avoid background noise. To help us call on you through Zoom, please raise your hand during the appropriate comment section, one of two ways. If you are attending on the Zoom platform, please raise your hand in Zoom. If you are new to Zoom and have joined our meeting using the application, please click on the hand icon at the bottom of your screen. When you click on the hand, it will raise your hand for us. Second, if you are joining our meeting via the phone, please press star 9, not pound 9, but star 9 on your keypad to raise your hand, make a comment. If you are calling in and want to view the meeting, including the PowerPoint presentations, please view the meeting through our CalSPAN Live website webcast link. There will be a slight time delay, but it will avoid an echo or feedback from using the Zoom application and your phone. We will call on individuals who have raised their hands in the order that they are raised, using the name they registered with or the last three digits of their identifying phone number. You may receive a pop-up indicating you are being promoted to panelist. Please be sure to accept that invitation. After you are called on, you will be unmuted so you can share your comments. Please remember to unmute your computer or phone and identify yourself. Please keep your comments respectful and focused, or we will mute anyone who fails to follow these guidelines or, at worst, dismiss them from the meeting. I'd like to remind everyone that we do have two general public comment opportunities. If anyone is having logistical or technical difficulties, please reach out to slc.helpdesk@slc.ca.gov so we can assist you in connecting. Please know that you have another opportunity to provide comments at the end of our meeting. The Commission has also established an email address to compile public comments for our meetings. The address is cslccommissionmeetings@slc.ca.gov. We have received various emails from parties that have been shared with the commissioners prior to the meeting. If we receive any emails during the meeting, they will be shared with the commissioners and made available on our website. Chair Kunalakis, that concludes my hybrid meeting instructions. We're ready to move to the public comment period.
Thank you so much, Ms. Cato. Our next order of business is the public comment period. If anyone would like to address the commission, again, on any matter not on today's agenda, staff will call on those who are here in person first. Next, we will move on to those joining us virtually. Jeff, please call on the first person who would like to make a public comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first person we have for public comment is Neil Desai, I believe in person. Neil, please come on up.
There we go. Good afternoon, Honorable Chair Kunalakis and members of this commission. Hope you're doing well. Hope you've had a really nice summer, staff as well. Maybe take some time to visit a national or state park here in California or around the country. My name is Neil Desai. I'm the Senior Regional Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. We advocate for our national parks. I'm here just to provide an update on the Cadiz groundwater mining proposal. I first want to thank the commission and staff for your letter to the company in June to put it on notice of its responsibilities. This is not the first time you've had to, but really appreciate you doing that. Your concern about the company and its efforts to evade oversight is not just limited to the state. Last month, our U.S. senators, Alex Padilla and Adam Schiff, wrote a letter to Secretary of Interior Doug Burgum. I have copies with Grace over here for you all, expressing their concerns about what's happening at the federal level and the company's history and pattern of working with this federal administration and even in its prior first administration to evade the oversight at the federal level. I just want to read one sentence from this letter. Department of the Interior experts, including the U.S. Geological Survey and the National Park Service, as well as peer-reviewed scientific analyses, have warned of the significant and irreversible impacts that Cadiz's project could have on federal lands and surrounding communities. I think this speaks to the concern and our stewardship that you all have shown for California. I just want to make sure you're aware of that and see where our federal leaders are and the actions that they're taking. Their concern has also been heightened by something that you all have described at your December meeting on this topic, which is a lack of transparency on this issue. Turns out that a wholly owned subsidiary of the company is handling the lobbying for the company in D.C. They just hired David Bernhardt. If you recall, he was Trump administration in the first time around, the Secretary of Interior on the board of Truth Social, and Cadiz's former lawyer. So we're concerned. Thank you very much for your efforts. Hope you have a wonderful rest of your meeting and summer, too. Enjoy it if you can.
Thank you, Mr. Desai. Jeff, may we have the next speaker, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. Our next speaker is Adam Leverins. Adam, you are welcome to unmute and speak at this time.
Hi, is my audio coming in?
Yes, it is. We can hear you.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. Again, as Jeff said, Adam Leverins. I first spoke before this commission April 2024 in person in San Pedro, and I apologize that you folks have heard from me at virtually every meeting since then. Over that time, though, I look at the agendas for each meeting, and I think I have detected a pattern indicative of policy, and further study would confirm that for me. But on today's consent calendar, items 1 through 3, 6 through 15, 17 through 20, 22 and 23 are all general leases for recreational use over state waters at various places throughout the state, Lake Tahoe, Donner Lake, Sacramento River, et cetera. And I've noticed that in each of these, the lease term is 10 years. Within the consent agenda today, there are other leases that run for 29 years and 49 years. And I just asked the commission to reflect on what it might mean when a trustee grants that lease term to a group of users, but then for another group of users, restricts their term to 1 year and hopes to reduce it down to a 1 month. And then on a parallel note, I've heard from the State Lands Commission staff numerous times that you act in the capacity in like a landlord-tenant relationship. And that would make the trustee kind of like the middleman. The people pay the rent, you folks manage, the trustees are the middleman. And if you encounter a trustee that through documented public records indicates the loss of many millions of dollars from the Tidelands Fund, do you really wish to continue to work closely with that trustee? And perhaps it's time to refer these matters to the legislature and the Attorney General's office. And you'll hear what I'm talking about under an agenda item later. And I thank you all so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Jeff, next speaker, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our next speaker is Janet Rogers, whose comment will be accompanied by a presentation.
Ms. Rogers, please proceed.
I'm trying to get my video to go. Okay. I'm waiting for my slideshow to come up.
Do we have, yeah?
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I'm Janet Rogers, co-chair of the Embarcadero Coalition in San Diego. The public trust doctrine is about public trust as well as land and water management. Is the criteria for visitor-serving activities changing? Next slide. The public trust doctrine is evolving. Our concern is that it's devolving. The Port of San Diego is changing the visitor-serving definition to support making money. Changes to the public trust doctrine should be done in a transparent fashion and engage the public. Please don't do deals in secret to change allowable uses. Next slide. Homes are not allowed on the port-managed land, but Chula Vista swapped land with the port. Technically, there will be homes on port tidelands. Next slide. Your analysis of the Seaport project said the indoor event center was not supporting any coastal-related function. The developer put an outside balcony for parents to have a drink. Does that make it compliant? Next slide. Golf does not serve a water-related visit to the bay. The Port Master Plan updated created a new category that is not in the public trust doctrine. Golf is visitor-enhancing. Have you agreed to this? Why aren't you evaluating the Port Master Plan replacement since they are changing definition? Next slide. The port is planning a Topgolf facility. Your staff told me it's being considered because the doctrine is evolving and is part of a larger complex with restaurants and other features. Since when do restaurants make something else incidental or visitor serving? Next slide. Based on what we're being told, that what combination of restaurants or hotels make non-compliant uses suddenly okay? Will tennis clubs and casinos and things like this be available? Is the public trust doctrine devolving? Next slide. Another non-coastal related sports activity is being considered in Chula Vista. It's anchored by a tennis club with professional teams, IMAX, and a stadium. Port Commissioner's rally cry is progress over policy. They scoffed at a master plan. The public trust doctrine is ignored. Next slide. Last slide. The changes are being proposed affect the whole California coast. Are you opening the floodgates to everything being allowed? Please save our public access, our coastal environment, and keep the public trust. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jeff, next speaker, please.
Our next speaker is Pamela Hetherington. Pamela, you are welcome to speak at this time.
Thank you kindly. I am Pam Hetherington from the Environmental Center of San Diego. I also serve as co-lead for the 30 by 30 partnership in the San Diego region. Good morning, commissioners. I want to take this moment to thank the California State Lands Commission for your steadfast commitment to protecting our state's public trust lands. These lands are unique and irreplaceable. They provide not only access and enjoyment for all Californians, but also serve vital habitat and resilience for our coastlines, waterways, and communities. At a time when pressures on our coast and public lands are mounting, whether from development, climate change, or other competing uses, your vigilance matters more than ever. The actions of this commission must directly protect the public's right to access, the health of our ecosystems, and the long-term integrity of California's natural heritage. I wrote this before attending a meeting with the Port of San Diego yesterday about their Topgolf proposal, where we were confronted with what happens when an entity like the port is given judge, jury, and executioner status to run rampant on public trust lands, where moneyed interests trump the general public. So on behalf of those of us who value and rely on the coast, the rivers, the wetlands, and the lands under your care, I want to express gratitude and encourage you to uphold your dedication to protecting what belongs to all of us by ensuring these lands are safeguarded for navigation, fishing, recreation, environmental health, and future generations. You carry forward a tradition of stewardship that truly belongs to the people of California. And in closing, I just want to remind the commissioners that when the port does things like what Janet Rogers just explained to you, it falls on the Coastal Commission to reevaluate the presentation. And in that tone, the Coastal Commission gets back. So please, please protect the public lands for the public. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jeff, next speaker, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our next speaker is Peter Kaz. Peter, you are welcome to unmute and speak at this time.
Hi, I just want to speak on agenda item 66, not on the public comment. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jeff, next speaker, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, our next speaker is Albert Ramirez. Albert, you are welcome to unmute and speak at this time.
Sure. Thank you so much, commissioners. My name is Albert Ramirez. I am the president of ILWU, Local 56 Environmental Hazmat and Ship Scalers Union. We do work at tie lines and thumbs, and just sharing that we are in the midst of contract negotiations with Patriot Environmental Services, owned by Crystal Clean. And they do work contracted to the California Resources Corporation. And we've been bargaining with Patriot Environmental Services for quite some time. We're hopeful for an amicable outcome with collective bargaining. We have two more bargaining sessions next week. We did do a tour of the Thailand and Thumbs at the Port of Long Beach. And just want to do a kudos to the Port of LA and the Port of Long Beach for being such great partners. But nonetheless, we just wanted to share with the California State Lands Commission that we are the workers that make sure that we protect our environment with spills and emergency responses. We welcome the State Land Commission to engage our union, our local, and our rank and file, and our sisters and brothers. But nonetheless, we are hopeful for an outcome that's favorable to working families with Patriot Environmental Services that provide emergency response and maintenance at Thumbs and Thailands at the Port of Long Beach. But we want to just echo that we've been trying to work together with the employer that do work with the California Resources Corporation. So just sharing that, and thank you for your time and opportunity to participate in this virtual Zoom call. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much for presenting today. Jeff, next speaker.
Our next speaker is Lori Smith. Lori, please unmute and speak.
Hi, my name is Lori Smith, and I'm a resident of Dana Point in Orange County. And my comments are regarding the protection of sea lion and seal haul-out areas in Dana Point Harbor under the public trust doctrine and legislative grant to Orange County. I'm speaking in order that the State Lands Commission urge Orange County and all relevant agencies to uphold their legal and fiduciary obligations under the California Public Trust Doctrine and the state's legislative granting statutes in their management of Dana Point Harbor, which is currently undergoing renovation. Specifically, I request that the protection and preservation of traditional sea lion and seal haul-out areas on harbor docks that are also serve as valuable public recreation and educational sites. For many decades, this has been a cherished location for both wildlife and the public, and the presence of sea lions and seals regularly observed resting on specific dock areas provides not only essential marine mammal habitat, but also unparalleled public opportunities for wildlife observation, education, and enjoyment. These benefits are squarely within the purposes of the public trust doctrine and require the tide lands and submerged lands to be maintained for the benefit of all Californians. Unfortunately, I've noticed that fencing and other deterrents have been used in areas historically for these haul-out sites. And equally troubling is the removal of educational signage of these marine mammals and education and encourage respectful public viewing. These actions diminish both the environmental value of the harbor and public's enjoyment to learn from these vital coastal resources. Moreover, these docks and submerged lands in Dana Point are held in trust by Orange County under a legislative grant and must be used in accordance. I specifically urge the State Lands Commission to conduct a public trust consistency review to ensure that modifications to the harbor and docks do not affect wildlife in public areas, prohibit the physical deterrents, restore educational science, and develop a long-term coexistence plan. I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Jeff, next speaker, please.
Our next speaker is Eileen Boken. Eileen, you are welcome to unmute and speak.
Eileen Boken, Coalition for San Francisco Neighborhoods, speaking on my own behalf. On August 4th, I sent an email to the State Lands Commission, the Ocean Protection Council, the Coastal Commission, and the Greater Farallones National Marine Sanctuary regarding the discovery of the cause of sea star wasting disease. I would urge these agencies to work collaboratively on the restoration of sunflower sea stars, reducing the populations of purple sea urchins, and restoration of kelp forests. New subject. I would also want to comment on consent item number 5 for the Fort Bragg offshore desalination pilot project. Offshore desal would be a well-suited to fully built-out cities such as San Francisco. Also, it could potentially be used in conjunction with the city's emergency firefighting water system. Also, could it potentially be fitted with climate change instrumentation to measure ocean temperature, salinity, CO2 in the air, and dissolve CO2 in the water? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jeff, next speaker, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our next speaker is Odette Moran. Odette, you are welcome to unmute and speak at this time.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Odette Moran, pronounced with Anders, and I'm a youth and young adult community organizer here in Oxnard. Here to ask, because once our community is very tired to have the Oran Beach Generating Station continue to operate in our community, and to please ask to not amend the lease. And please, if you're going to have a decision-making meeting, please come here to Oxnard so our community is able to participate. Thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate all the comments y'all have been receiving for this today, because our community is very tired, and we want to make sure that this power plant is out of our community for good. Thank you so much, and I hope you have a lovely day.
Thank you very much. Jeff, next speaker, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have no other speakers at this time.
Thank you very much. That concludes our first public comment period. The next item of business will be the adoption of the minutes from the Commission's meeting of June 3rd and July 29th, 2025. May I have a motion to approve both sets of minutes and a second?
So moved.
May I have a second?
Second.
We have a motion from Commissioner Perot and a second from Commissioner Brownfield. Any objections to a unanimous vote? If not, motion passes unanimously. Ms. Kate, so the next order of business is the exec. We need to clean that up a little bit, Kate. For the next time, it's a little. I think generally these a unanimous vote is acceptable. All right. The next order of business is the executive officer's report. Ms. Cato, may we have that report, please?
Thank you, Chair. I'll make sure the new executive officer takes care. My full acting executive officer's report is available on the Commission's website. We've had several staffing changes from our June meeting that I'd like to highlight for everyone. As you know, Dr. Matt Dumlau was appointed by the commission to be our new executive officer and will join staff on this side of the table as of September 1. Seven working days, including today, not that I'm counting.
Funny.
Dr. Larry Raymond will be the new manager of our Climate Adaptation and Special Initiatives team. Jeanette Francis joined our Human Resources team, and Emma Applegarth joined our Records team. I also want to congratulate Gabriel Chapa, who was promoted to Senior Mineral Resources Engineer, and Michael Sapinar, who was promoted to a Public Land Management Specialist 2. And then we've had another milestone hit by Michaela Mosier, who has celebrated her 25th year with the State Lands Commission. So we have lots of folks that have been here for a while. And if I may, I'd like to take this opportunity to just acknowledge some of the teams that work behind the scenes at the commission that don't rarely get recognized or seen as we see all of the staff reports moving forward, specifically our boundary and our title teams that touch all of the actions that the commission considers. They review the project locations and they determine the extent of the commission's jurisdiction. Our engineering and science teams that provide us with information necessary to generate lease and contract provisions that allow us to act as responsible stewards of the resources that are entrusted to us. The inspectors that are out in the field making sure that all of our improvements and vessels are in the right shape to operate safely in the state. Our administrative services team for paying our bills, managing the budget, collecting rent, keeping our records and our policies straight, all of the filing. We are still very paper heavy. We're working on that. And staffing our front desk, handling our fleet, including the boat that we have, and all manner of personnel functions. Our audits team who make sure that we are getting what we should be getting. And our IT team for keeping us connected, logged in, and for all of the systems that we use to do our jobs correctly. All of the work that shows up on the staff reports are really a collaboration of all of these teams working together. This is a great, great commission to work for, and I'm very happy to have been able to be here and even taking the helm for this limited period of time has been great. From the front desk receptionist to all of the commissioners, I just want to thank you for your patience and all of the support that you've given me. I would not have been able to do it without you all. So thank you. And that concludes my report.
Well, Grace, gracious, as always, it's your middle name, or I guess your first name. Seriously, I just want to say the changeover when you stepped up to serve as interim happened somewhat suddenly, for those who don't know. And it is such a testament to the team at State Lands that you all work together so well in concert with one another, that you had the support that you needed, that you had the unanimity of thought that you should step into this role. But to you personally, it is never an easy thing to do to step into the spotlight and to head up an organization as you have so skillfully over these this last interim period, it's been seamless. The issues that come before us at State Lands are often very complicated and controversial. You again aptly named, handled with grace. And then, frankly, in the process to find our permanent executive director with you staying on, all of that went just exceedingly well. And I come out of a management background myself. Having teams where people have mutual respect and appreciation for each other's expertise, willingness to work hard and after hours and put the mission first, we can't take that for granted. And in public service, at a time when even that is controversial in a way that I don't think we've ever seen before, it takes people who are committed, experienced, patient, and have backbones of steel, all of which you have. In addition, by the way, to just about the best chocolate chip cookies, which was not necessary, but greatly, greatly appreciated. So thank you for your service. And when we meet next time, we will have this report presented by your successor, Matthew Dumlau, who is here today as well. So thank you. Commissioners, would you like to say a few words, Commissioner Perot?
Well, I'll of course, second the comment about the chocolate chip cookies. Not that I maybe should be leading with that, but they are always a nice treat when we are running from multiple different places and we get to come here and it's like, okay, yeah, all right. But no, truly, I don't want to repeat everything the Lieutenant Governor has indicated, but just echo her same sentiments. We're glad. One, you handled everything that was thrown at you, and it has been a lot during this interim period. You've done it just smoothly and miraculously, and I really appreciate. Mm-hmm. I know with staff alongside, and you have an amazing staff. But truly, somebody had to stand up and lead and be the front of that staff. And I know at times it was probably not your comfort space to do so, but you did it and did it without any hesitation. And that not just speaks volumes to you, but speaks volumes to the team. So I am also glad we're not, we will still obviously be seeing you. You, I know, are happy to be returning back into your space that you so love and appreciate. Just again, want to echo the thank you for stepping up, and really to the whole team, and excited to sort of to get into what will be the new normal with a new leader. But we know that you will not be very far, and we now know where to get to you at. So don't think you can hide too much. But thank you again. Appreciate it.
Well, I mean, as we just only recently met, but it sounds like a lot of good things. So I will say on behalf of the controller and the commission, I'm sure if she were here, she would have a lot of things to say. So thank you very much.
All right. Jeff, do we have any public comments on the executive officer's report?
We do not have any public comment to the EO report.
Thank you. So the next order of business will be the adoption of the consent calendar. Commissioners, are there any items that you would like removed from the consent calendar? Next, I call on Ms. Cato to indicate which items, if any, have been removed from the consent calendar.
Thank you, Chair. Consent items 62, I can't do numbers, I'm flustered now. Consent items 61, 62, and 65 are removed from the agenda and will be considered at a later meeting.
Thank you very much. May I have a motion to adopt the consent calendar? A consent agenda? Oh, did I skip over?
She spoke. Eileen Boken had requested that consent item 5 be removed from the agenda, but I think she made her statements known in support of the project. My apologies.
Okay. We're good to go?
Okay.
May I have a motion?
So moved.
And a second?
Seconded.
Motion from Commissioner Perot, second from Commissioner Brownfield. Objections to unanimous vote? Motion passes. The next order of business will be the regular calendar. Ms. Cato, regular calendar.
Thank you. Item 66 is a presentation developed by the commission staff on the City of Newport Beach's public trust lands management, specifically the moorings and the discrepancy in pier rates. I'd like to invite Jeff Plovnik with our staff to make the staff presentation, please.
Thank you very much. Before you begin, because I think we've already had quite a few people to sign up for this item, because we want to hear from everyone, we're going to limit public comment for this item to 1 minute.
Thank you. Okay. Just waiting for the presentation to come up. There we go. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commissioners. I am Jeff Plovnik, Granted Lands Specialist with the Land Management Division, and I'm here to present on item 66. Next slide, please. This item concerns state sovereign lands in Newport Bay that were granted by the legislature to the City of Newport Beach. These lands are shown here through aerial imagery. In response to public concerns and commission direction, staff have been reviewing topics related to the city's mooring permit program since 2024 and have drafted a report regarding the city's management of mooring permits and residential piers in Newport Bay. This draft report is attached as Exhibit A to the staff report for this item. Next slide, please. The legislature originally granted the state's sovereign lands in Newport Bay to the city of Newport Beach in 1919. This grant was amended several times before being repealed and replaced in 1978 by the operative grant, Chapter 74, Statutes of 1978. The operative grant has been modified or amended multiple times since then. As with all grantees, the city is responsible for managing its legislatively granted lands within the guidelines of the public trust doctrine, the California Constitution, its granting statutes, and its fiduciary duties as a trustee of state lands. A few of the most important requirements from the city's grant include that the granted lands be used for purposes in which there is a general statewide interest, including a public harbor and recreational facilities open to the general public, that in the management, conduct, operation, and control of the lands or any improvements, betterments, or structures thereon, the city shall make no discrimination in rates, tolls, or charges for any use or service in connection therewith, and that in managing the granted lands, the city shall act in the statewide best interest. Next slide, please. To give you a better idea of what the city is managing, here is another depiction of Newport Beach granted lands from the city's GIS division, which shows the various mooring fields and anchorages within Newport Bay, the areas within the red dashed lines there. Most of these are directly managed by the city. Additionally, and not as clearly depicted here, the city also manages a permit program for numerous residential piers and docks adjacent to waterfront properties located on Newport Bay. Next slide, please. The city has discretion in determining how it manages its granted lands. However, these lands remain subject to the oversight authority of the state by and through the State Lands Commission, with the commission retaining all jurisdiction and authority remaining in the state for these lands. The commission's residual oversight authority is largely limited to reviewing the city's actions for consistency with the public trust doctrine, the California Constitution, the grant statutes, and its fiduciary duties. It is important to note that the commission is not authorized to impose its own discretionary decisions on the city. Such authority is reserved for the legislature through amendments to the grant. Next slide, please. Although the commission cannot impose its own discretionary decisions on the city, the operative grant does contain specific provisions regarding commission oversight. For example, per the grant statute, the commission can recommend amendments to the legislature if it determines that such amendments to the grant statute are necessary, and the commission can institute a formal inquiry to determine if the terms and conditions of the grant statute and any amendments thereto have been complied with in good faith. Additionally, the grant provides the commission with specific remedies to address instances in which the city violates its grant statutes or other provisions of law. For example, if the commission determines that any transaction or condition is in probable conflict with the grant statute or with any other provision of law, it can report to the legislature, which may direct the Attorney General to bring litigation to revoke the grant or compel compliance. Similarly, after holding a publicly noticed hearing at which the city has been given an opportunity to express fully any disagreement with the commission's findings or to describe any extenuating circumstances causing violations, the commission may formally request the Attorney General to bring litigation against the city to resolve a grant violation. Next slide, please. As mentioned earlier, staff have been reviewing topics related to the city's mooring permit program since 2024. During this time, staff have reviewed an appraisal the city performed for the purposes of setting new market rates for its mooring permits and determined that the appraisal was generally reasonable. Staff have also asked the city to delay full adoption of a proposed license program, which would ultimately lead, among other things, to phasing out the existing practice of private mooring permit transfers while also increasing rates for the use of city-managed mooring buoys. In preparation of the draft report, staff have reviewed decades of records, engaged with various stakeholders, and met with city staff. Staff's draft report evaluates whether the city has explained its discretionary actions, taking into consideration its legal obligations as a grantee. When the city's actions appear to conflict with their legal obligations to the state, the report identifies the potential legal violations so that the city may review its management practices and either provide additional justifications or make corrections as needed. Next slide, please. The findings of the report include that residential pier
rates... Jeff, I'm sorry. I'm going to stop you. Can you go back to the last slide? I just want to make sure that everybody understands the process, including me.
Of course.
So in January of 24, the city asks our commission staff to review their mooring rate appraisal.
Correct.
We sent a letter in April saying that we believed that their mooring rate appraisal was generally reasonable.
Yes.
But we also suggested they phase them in.
Correct.
And we also suggested they look at their residential peer rate.
Yes.
Okay. Then in July, after the city approved the license program, we asked them to delay the second reading of the ordinance. What is that in order for us to review?
To review the general management practices that the city is engaged in, I think largely due to public concerns and comment.
Okay. I just think this is really important because there's a division of authority and responsibility here, but it also sounds that originally staff, I mean, you put here that we thought it was generally reasonable, but then there were more questions raised, so you did a deeper dive. Is
we
that
did.
How you would?
Yes, and not just into the appraisal itself. The appraisal had been reviewed and is generally considered to be reasonable for the purposes of setting mooring rates, but the management practices overall of the city in regards to all of its granted lands and all the improvements thereon, the various permits and leases that they issue, have been reviewed since July of last year.
Okay. Go ahead and continue. I just think it's helpful for everybody to understand how we got here.
Of course. Thank you. If we could go to the next slide, please. All right. So the findings of the draft report include that residential peer rates appear significantly below market rates and that the rental area calculations for these peers may not reflect the true extent of private tidelands use. So as an example, depicted here on the left is how the city currently calculates rental area for residential peers. As you can see, the rental area, depicted in green, only applies to the area directly occupied by the pier and gangway. In comparison, on the right is an example that is more consistent with how the commission calculates rental area for docking facilities. As you can see, this area, outlined in green, encompasses the pier and gangway, as well as the interior of the slip and the surrounding area. This accounts for the areas in which a vessel would be moored, as these are effectively removed from public use due to the presence of the moored vessel and the public's general perception that those areas are reserved for use by the pier permittee. Next slide, please. The report's findings also include that the city can reasonably rely on its recent mooring appraisal to set rates for its mooring permits, and that there are clear differences in rate revisions for moorings and residential piers, which may violate the grant statutes and the California Constitution. As the report identifies, the trend for mooring permit rates has been to use regular appraisals to reflect market conditions, while the trend for residential pier permits has been to reduce the overall rental amount by reducing the lease area and lowering rates without conducting new or updated appraisals. It should be noted that the city has already taken the first steps towards addressing the pier rental rates by initiating an appraisal to determine fair market rent for residential pier permits. This appraisal is currently in progress. Next slide, please. This slide provides additional information regarding the differences between the current residential pier rates and the current and proposed rates for mooring buoys. The first table at the top of the slide is taken from the city's schedule of rents, fines, and fees for fiscal year 2025 to 26. As you can see here, the current rate for residential pier permits is 58 cents per square foot per year. In comparison, the table below, which was taken from the staff report for item 13 of the City Council's July 9th, 2024 meeting, which is the second reading of that ordinance, which was voted on at that meeting, is what we asked them to pause. But this table compares current slip rates, current mooring rates under the city's license program, and mooring rates from the city's appraisal. So at that July meeting, the City Council voted to accept changes to the existing license program that would eventually lead to all moorings being subject to the license program. However, as mentioned, the second reading of that ordinance was delayed at staff's request to allow staff time to conduct the review, which resulted in this report. As you can see, when the staff report was written, the current mooring rate for a 40-foot mooring, which is the most common size in Newport Bay, was $3.35 per lineal foot per month, or $1,608 per year, which is shown in the first bullet point on the right. This rate has changed slightly due to CPI adjustments in the intervening time, but it is a relatively minor change that accounts for roughly $30 per year. Under the license program, the rate for the same size mooring is $15 per linear foot per month, or $7,200 per year. And for comparison, if the current pier rate was applied to the area impacted by a 40-foot mooring, which is estimated at 1,200 square feet, then this would result in rent of $696 per year. However, it must be noted that piers and moorings are not equivalent uses, so comparing them is not apples to apples, but this comparison does still provide some context for the differences in rates.
Okay, just to clarify, yep. So you're saying for a 40-foot boat, mm-hmm. if it were on a pier, it would probably be paying somewhere around $696 a year.
Not necessarily. So the pier rate would be based on the square footage of the pier facility, the dock itself, that it occupies on state land. If we were to apply the rate that they assess for those piers, though, to the square footage that a 40-foot mooring occupies within open water, which is 1,200 square feet as estimated by the city's appraiser, that would account there. That would lead to $696 per year in rent.
But if I understand, you said it's not apples to apples. But if you were trying to compare, wouldn't you say the rough size of a pier for a 40-foot boat?
It could be larger. It would really depend on the specific footprint of that pier.
Okay, but let's say it's a typical footprint that you would have for a 40-foot boat,
mm-hmm.
what would that be currently per year, roughly?
I couldn't say. It would really depend on the exact square footage of that particular pier. So as an example, a 1,200-square-foot dock.
There's not an average size?
There might be an average size. I'm not aware of what it would
be. I'm just not sure why this is useful to why would it be useful to us really at all to have a pier rate
It's
quantified
for,
if that's not what people are actually paying to use pier, wouldn't we want to know? I mean, that's how ordinary people would experience it,
correct.
Right?
I think the intent for the comparison here is just to highlight that for coverage over the same space, it highlights that the piers are actually devalued, too low. So I think that was the intent of the But it's not, like you said, it's not an apple to apple.
So are you saying then a pier? So is that a median priced $696? Is that a median price of what it would cost to have a pier that would fit a 40-foot boat?
We don't have that exact data. What we have is what they
provide. Is anybody out there paying $696 a year for a pier?
I don't know. We can look and get back to you. I think what staff was trying to highlight was that if you had a 1,200 square foot footprint of a pier, the yearly
why is that relevant if it isn't?
It's only in comparison to what the footprint of a mooring is. That was what the intent for the
comparison
was.
Yeah, I understand, but it seems irrelevant to me. I mean, the question that I would want to know and that what we're hearing from people is we're paying $1,608 a year today to moor a 40-foot boat, and they want to move it to $7,200 a year. You're showing us something that indicates that a similar methodology would price a pier, a 1,200-square-foot pier, at this lower rate. But you're not explaining to us what in reality is the current rate for a residential pier in the same way, of just roughly around the same size that would house that type of a boat. I mean, if you're trying to exemplify how much less it is for a pier, you need to tell us what people are in reality paying for that pier.
I suppose it would be on a per square foot basis is what we're comparing here. So if we were to take the 1,200 square feet that are supposedly occupied by a 40-foot vessel on a mooring, and we were to divide the $7,200 per year by that 1,200 square feet, you would end up with a rate per square foot that is significantly higher than the pier rate.
The picture you showed us earlier that showed the envelope of the pier.
Could we go back? Two slides.
Is that a 1,200 square foot? The one on the picture on the left, is that?
That is not. It would be hard to say. I can't recall what the exact square footage of those are.
Roughly.
But you could put, for example, a 40-foot boat in those slips. But the way that the city calculates the rent, the one on the left there, would be for the exact area over which that dock sits and does not account for the U-shaped space in the middle where you would generally put a boat.
I know that, but I want to know how much is that pier.
I couldn't tell you, but I can find out for you.
Chair Kunalakis, maybe what we can do is actually set up a specific
I don't want to come back on this. I just want to understand. People are saying it's much, much cheaper to rent a pier than it is to rent a mooring, and that's not fair. I want to understand from you, is that true? Do you have information that shows in this presentation that that's the case?
In absolute numbers, in terms of what one pays per year, I don't have that information. In terms of a per square foot value, I do.
And is that per square foot what they're calculating the rent on?
Yeah. It's not per square foot for the moorings. That's based on a linear foot basis for the length, and the piers are per square foot. So again, it's not fully apples to apples, but you can slice the numbers into per square foot.
That's part of our concern with the inconsistency in terms of how the moorings are being calculated and how the piers are being calculated. So I'd like to say it's super straightforward, and it's not. The rates that are charged for the piers are based on the square footage themselves. The rates that are paid for the moorings are based on an entirely different calculation, including the occupation of the space by the vessel as well. So it was really hard to do a true apples-to-apples comparison for this. So I was thinking one of the things that we could do as staff while we're getting these comments from folks is to create a specific scenario where you can see all of the different rates being applied to the same exact scenario and showcasing the difference.
Can we do that as part of
yes.
this item? Okay.
Yes.
See what you can find. I mean, I'm looking at that. I know what 1,200 square feet is. It's a little hard to tell the scale mm-hmm. there. But I think even if it's somewhere close to that, you're looking at a massive difference.
The difference, as Jeff was saying, for if you calculate backwards on what the mooring holders are paying under the proposed permit is approximately $6 per square foot. So you can calculate versus 58 cents per square foot for the pier holders. So that's the discrepancy. And maybe that's more helpful just as a general rule than trying to equate it out. But that is taking an average mooring and what they occupy and what that would look like per square foot. So that is, a 12-fold difference?
Yeah.
Got it.
So, yeah.
All right.
And that's really the conclusion of the draft report.
Can I just ask, is on the picture on the left, so they're just accounting for the space of the actual dock or pier?
Correct.
On the right, could a mooring, I guess my question is, could a mooring that's accounting for the space of the vessel, could the pier space there be small? Could that be smaller than a mooring when that's including the space on both, like a U-shaped one at least, where it's including the space on both the outside, the inside, and the outside? Would it be possible for that to be smaller than the 40, or at least given this picture? We don't know the scale of it, but.
Right. It's possible. If we're assuming that slip can hold a 40-foot vessel, the area occupied just by the interior of that slip is probably reasonably close to the
mooring.
Exactly.
So the mooring wouldn't include, though, then two strips of dock and then the outside of that. So
correct.
A mooring would be less space mm-hmm. than that. Okay.
And as an example, so the outside area outside of the slip probably also has cleats. As you can see at the top of the picture there's a smaller vessel moored on that side. So that's why we calculate that whole area. The entirety of that area, or anywhere where a vessel could reasonably be moored, is an impact area when the commission looks at similar facilities.
Okay. We good? Go. You can go back to the slide where you were.
Thank you. Thank you. Could we please go forward to slide 10? One more. Thank you very much. Okay, so the last bullet, which I believe is where I was, shows the Commission's current Southern California benchmark for recreational mooring facilities of 45.1 cents per square foot, last updated in 2022. When applied to the same 1,200 square feet impacted by a 40-foot mooring, the benchmark provides an annual rent of $541. Please keep in mind that this benchmark uses data collected from numerous marinas in Southern California and that the marinas in Newport Beach tend to have the highest rates of those surveyed. So the fact that the Commission's benchmark is lower than the other rates shown here is not surprising. Next slide, please. The rest of staff's findings detail that the private sale of mooring permits allowed by the city's transfer policy appears to violate the city's grant statutes, its fiduciary obligations to the state, and the public trust doctrine, that the city should review the action it adopted on July 9, 2024, to ensure that this action provides a fair solution that addresses the topics discussed in the report, and that overall, when reviewing the city's actions over the last several decades, it is evident that the city has not adequately explained how its granted lands management decisions comply with its obligations as the state's trustee under the granting statute.
I'm sorry. This conclusion does not seem to follow in my mind from the presentation. Can you tell me what is it about the private sale of mooring permits under the city's transfer policy that appears to violate the public trust doctrine?
Absolutely. And that is detailed in great detail in the report. In general, the two primary concerns with the existing transfer policy is the gift of public funds, which would be a violation of the California Constitution, and what is effectively the privatization of public land. The privatization of public land is a little bit easier for me to describe. Because the private transfers can occur, you could look at one person taking their mooring permit, which is basically a permit that allows them to occupy a space of public land. They can transfer that to whomever they want. It could be to, you know, their son or daughter, a relative, and then that transfer can continue essentially forever. And so that land never actually becomes available to the public at large again.
Okay, so this has nothing to do with the rate.
No.
It has to do with the different components.
Correct. It's a separate issue, and this arose out of staff's overall review of the city's tidelands management as a whole, not simply the rates.
Okay. Is there anything here in this conclusion about the rates?
That was in an earlier finding. The main conclusion on the rates is that the city's appraisal is generally reasonable and that they...
For the moorings.
For the moorings, correct. And that the peer rates, that an appraisal for fair market value of those is in progress at the moment.
And not just the per square foot rates, but the way that it's assessed, whether it's, you know, what the footprint...
Correct. We've spoken to the city about that. Once the appraisal is delivered, we will likely have further discussions with the city. Our perspective would be that the manner in which the rent is assessed probably does not accurately reflect the private or the tidelands that are being used by the peer permittees.
Okay.
Where are we? Next slide, please. Staff intend for the analysis and recommendations in this report to provide guidance to the city on how it should review and revise its residential pier and mooring programs and how to analyze additional issues, even if those issues are not directly or comprehensively discussed in this report. Staff hope that the city works collaboratively with the commission to address these issues, but if necessary, staff will present additional steps for commission consideration, which could include legal proceedings in coordination with the Attorney General's office. As mentioned, this report is in draft form, and staff welcomes written comments in response to this draft. Members of the public can submit comments by emailing grantedlands.public@slc.ca.gov. This email address is shown on screen now, is within the staff report for this item and can be found on the Granted Lands Program landing page on the Commission's website. Staff will review public comments that are received and revise the report as needed, taking into account all of the comments received. Staff anticipates presenting a final report at the December 2025 Commission meeting. Next slide, please. Thank you. That concludes staff's presentation. Staff is available to answer any more questions you might have.
Commissioners, if I may.
Yes.
Jeff, could you please explain a little bit of what the City of Newport ultimately voted on and did their first reading? What is the proposed plan currently before the city
and, absolutely,
and pending? Thank you.
Yeah. Excuse me one second.
We'll do public comment and then come back.
So the ordinance that the City Council voted on is to transition to a license program. Currently, it's a permit program. This nomenclature will become important as we go back and forth between the two. The license program would lead to the eventual phase out of the existing transfer policy. It would see that all moorings under the license program are subject to the license rate, which is that currently that $15 per linear foot rate for a 40-foot mooring, and would change it from... It would change it from the permits as they are. It eventually leads to the phase out of liveaboards. Currently, there's liveaboards on the permits. Those liveaboards, as it was rented, can remain where they are now. But once the permit transfers to a license program, which happens either upon one final transfer of the permit, which is allowed to occur under what the city voted on, or when the permit is otherwise relinquished, say if the permittee passes on, then the permit becomes a license, liveaboards are no longer allowed, and it becomes subject to the license rates. As City Council voted on it, the existing permits and the existing permittees would remain subject to the existing permit rate. They would be allowed to transfer their permits one time during a specific limited period of time, and if they don't transfer them, would remain subject to the existing permit rates, subject to CPI adjustment for as long as they have the permit. And then after that sunset date of transfers, should they relinquish the permit, then it transfers to a license. Under the license program as well, the city would own all of the mooring tackle, whereas currently mooring permittees own and maintain the tackle.
I just wanted to bring it up because I think that what the city was trying to do was sort of a middle ground. It was a sort of a settlement position where they grandfathered in existing mooring owners at the existing rate. So the $1,608 per year plus CPI, or $1,638 it would be. So current mooring holders that we're hearing from could, if the second reading of that ordinance goes through, still have the opportunity to stay at the lower rate for as long as they maintain their permit, and they would have one transfer within a what year window? 5 year? 4 year window.
It's a few years.
Yeah, so there is an opportunity for a transfer if a current mooring owner and vessel owner was looking at doing that, and that would grandfather that one transfer in before the city would have this return back into their new license program, which does have the higher rates. Yeah. So it is a middle position. Staff has looked at it, and again, I think what Jeff really highlighted and what our legal team looked at was the sufficiency of the appraisal. Appraisals are a little bit like artwork. Different people will disagree about final calculations and final outcomes, but as a general rule, there weren't any significant red flags as far as the outcomes. But I just wanted to highlight where the city actually sat relative to the rest of the recommendations in the staff
report. All right, we're going to hear public comment, but just while we're on this.
Yeah, can I just ask a clarification between the license program and the permitting program? On the permitting program, how long are the permits good for? Is there no end date?
They're indefinite.
They're just indefinite.
As long as
they're maintaining their mooring.
They can be revoked for cause, but as long as they keep paying their fees, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. So, and they can transfer one time with a limited under this. On the licensing program, and I'm sorry, maybe you said this and I missed it. Is that also the case? They're going to pay the higher amount. They're no longer responsible for the mooring maintenance, and they don't own the actual buoy itself. But are those licensed also in perpetuity? Is there no?
They become month to month and automatically renew every month, assuming, again, that fees are paid.
And is there periodic review? Because to your point about the fact that these are public lands, if there's no end date, what opportunity do those, is there access for public land or public use at that point, right? Is it, I guess that's my other question. Is there, was there, was that part of the reason for moving to a licensing piece that I missed?
In the same manner that, for example, a marine buoy rented by the commission would become available again, the license holders can continue to renew that, mm-hmm. but eventually it will be relinquished and will go back to the city.
When they relinquish it, but correct. There's no, unless there's, is there there's also cause within there, that?
It can be revoked well? for cause by the city, yeah, but.
Okay.
It's an additional item, quite frankly, that we're actually looking at because we have questions about how this will be managed over the long haul. I mean, obviously with something like open mooring buoys in a mooring field that's open to the general public, there needs to be an opportunity for the general public to participate. And so there are some questions that are still pending, part of the larger conversation that we have with the city of Newport.
Okay. Can I ask one other question?
Sorry, of course.
Lieutenant Governor, I know mm-hmm. you, on the pier permits, and I know we've already indicated to them as part of our finding, and I understand that within our jurisdiction at state lands, we don't get to set necessarily the rates, but we are reviewing, and it sounds like both rates, mooring or pier, were too low at one, and so now they both are indicating both need to be increased. But on the pier, and back, I guess to the question the Lieutenant Governor was asking also earlier, on the again, my concern is the public access piece. We have indicated they should be. Subject to having to, the square footage should be subject to not just the pier itself, but the you know, inside the horseshoe, so to speak, where the boat actually sits, as well as portion on the other, either side of the docks, because that's where they may be, you know, docking a smaller vessel on the outside, which I get. But again, I guess my question goes back to the public access piece. There's never really an opportunity for public access, is there? We're going to charge them because they've taken up public access, but there's not really. I guess my question is the city not required to say, no, you can only have a vessel on the inside so there is public access on the exteriors of each of the docks?
The city could. I mean, the city could pass its own ordinances for.
But we don't have any concern as far as our jurisdiction on that, I guess.
No, not in the same way. And I'll just highlight that.
Can you explain the why on that?
One of the difficulties or the kind of significant differences legally between moorings, like open moorings and piers, is that piers are an incident of the upland ownership. The moorings are not necessarily, so these open pieces are more intentionally available for general public use. But as a general rule, the State Lands Commission and our grantees do not offer piers to a third party that has no upland property rights because it would create inherent trespass issues and other things. So it's really an incidence and a privilege of an upland owner to have that right. That said, in the same way that we issue piers in Tahoe and throughout, the city of Newport has the ability to set certain standards on, you know, what they would like to see or limitations on the degree or number of potential mooring sites on a pier. They could say, for example, no external cleats. We'll only allow for internal pier usage. And we've seen a lot of things like this in places like Huntington Harbor and where there is a significant outgrowth of piers. And again, we generally just highlight the fact that it is a public trust consistent use, the piers are, because it's actually access for waterborne activities with boats, but that there are clear limitations and trade-offs as it pertains to other potential public trust uses in that space. And that's where for example, the reason why we have our impact area, we say you pay for the entirety of the area used or the perception that the public has that it's privatized.
Okay. Let's move to public comment. But here's what I want to say before we get started and dive into this to those who are here to public. This commission does not set the rates for the pier. Okay, this is not our call. This is the city's call. People have come to us because we do have an underlying requirement to make sure that the public trust doctrine is met. But that is a very limited scope of authority that we have. And just to speak in plain English, it does seem that many of the folks who were upset about the increase in the rates for the moorings came to us. We have issued this report. It may not be what you were necessarily looking for, but it was appropriate for us to issue this review. But I just want to be clear that even though it is in draft form, you can submit comments. Staff has already done a pretty thorough review of the level of authority that we have and made comments as the city council works to determine what the appropriate charges should be for both the moorings and the piers and the way that it's calculated. Okay, all right. So with that, why don't we, Katie, start with the public comment 1 minute per person. And can you just tell me to start how many people we have signed up?
We currently have 13 people signed up.
Okay. All right. Go ahead. Please proceed with the first.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Who would like to make a comment?
For our first speaker, we have Anne Stinton. Mm-hmm. Anne, you should be able to unmute yourself, and your presentation is being pulled up now.
I'll just wait for my presentation. Okay, well, while I'm waiting for my presentation, I'll just say my name is Anne Stenton, and on behalf of the Newport Mooring Association, I do want to thank the commissioners and the staff for their extensive effort on this. I know it's a very complex issue, and I also want to thank the commissioners for their thoughtful questions, and this is why we're also asking for a special meeting in September, because there is just so much to go over, and we've had less than 48 hours to kind of look at this. So I want to say thank you, but you know, there's a few things that really stood out to me, and one of them is this perceived potential profit that mooring holders are making, and I would love to see more evidence of that, if that's actually happening. I haven't seen that, and it's hard to respond to it, but there is some evidence that, you know, pier holders are making significant income from renting their piers. This is just a couple of examples, and not that I have anything against renting piers, because it does provide coastal access, but this is, you know, they're paying a lot less, as you pointed out, and they're also making a lot where we're not allowed to rent or anything like that. So the concern about recouping the cost at the end of a mooring permit, you know, it's interesting to me that there's this focus on it. Next slide, please. And then there was also a question about just, you know, what are piers paying and what are moorings paying? This gives you an idea from the 23-24 financial year. You know, this is looking at what money is going into the Tidelands Fund. I would like to point out that the mooring permit system, as it currently exists, pays significant money into the Tidelands Fund, which is a public benefit. We also do offer access to the public, and there are many empty moorings. If somebody wants a mooring, I would definitely argue that the transfer system that's in place right now is really the reason I'm here. I'm a public teacher. My principal's been very generous with my time today, so I could be here, but without the current transfer system in place, I don't know that I would be here. And our community is very working class. So I would really encourage, next slide, please. I would really encourage this commission to have a special meeting. Please help us end the bias in Tidelands permit rates. I know you're working towards that. And I would also argue that there's just so much more that needs to be addressed and looked at here. So please, we need your help. Please hold a special meeting so we can respond to this more thoroughly and the public has more time to engage with this process. Thank you.
Thank you. Katie, next speaker, please.
Thank you. Our next public speaker is Samantha McDonald, followed by Jim Palmer.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Awesome. I'm Sam McDonald. I'm a level board. Oh my gosh, I have so much to say, and I really hope you consider having a meeting, a special meeting for this, because there's just so much to review with so little time. I just want to say that I am a level board, and as your staff pointed out, this community is about to face extinction with this conversion to city licenses. And if you accept this draft as it is without even addressing that, you're basically holding us as a death sentence for level boards and for future level boards especially. And this is a profound contradiction, because while the State Lands Commission has charged by executive order by Gavin Newsom to find and create affordable housing solutions, you're letting Newport Beach eliminate one, and you're eradicating who we are. And this is just absolutely frustrating to see the staff not want to address this whatsoever when it is in your purview. So I really encourage you to look in the fact that this will eradicate us. This is one of the last standing liveaboard places in California. Please don't let that happen. Please look at the fact that yacht clubs can still transfer to whoever they want. Peers can transfer to whoever they want. And we need to get this across in terms of the discrimination continues under the city license with the proposals that staff have in place. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next speaker, please.
Our next speaker is Jim Palmer, who has a video to share. Jim, you should be able to unmute yourself. Jim, perhaps while you figure out how to unmute yourself, we'll go to the next speaker and then we'll come right back to you. For our next speaker, we have Mike Fleming.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, just very basically, as Sam and Ann both mentioned, there are so many different things to discuss that are, as you said, not apples to apples, apples to oranges. And to look at the residential piers in comparison to moorings seems to be you're missing the point that the residential piers are run like private marinas, that, you know, when I'm paying what I pay for my mooring, a charter boat would pay $3,500 to sit in the same space that the mooring is less. But that money isn't going to the city or the state. That money's going to the residential pier holder. And there, and if you get a permit for a fuel dock or for a marina, I'm sure you pay a percentage of your profit for your permit because you're making a profit. The residential pier holders, many of which are making huge profits. And I think that has to be looked at.
Thank you very much. Next speaker, please. Katie?
Thank you. For our next speaker, we'll go to Michael Spano, what? And then we'll try Jim Palmer again.
What did you say?
I said, tell me your liveaboard.
Michael? Please proceed.
Good afternoon. Can you guys hear me?
We cannot hear you.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes, but if you could speak a little louder.
Okay, well, good afternoon, Honorable Chair and Commissioners. I'm Michael Spano. I have a PhD from the University of California, and I also live aboard my sailboat in Newport Beach. I have concerns with this draft. There's so much I would like to talk about, but I only have 50 seconds. So the NETSER appraisal, this staff report says that it is a reasonable appraisal, but it is like artwork, and it's a Picasso. It is a total outlier among four very reputable sources for setting fair market prices, like the California State Lands Commission benchmark calculations, an independent CBRE appraisal, the city's residential pier rates, where if they doubled, it would still be cheaper to have a pier than a mooring. And lastly, all other moorings in the state of California. This is a resource for all Californians. It shouldn't be jacked up. And well, one last thing, while we were discussing the U-shaped pier, I calculated that pier. It's 650 square feet times 58 cents per year. That pier pays somewhere shy of $400 per year. I pay $1,600 to $1,800. And under, I would be paying $7,000, which is 28 times higher than the State Lands Commission benchmark. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for doing that math for us, Michael. Next speaker, please.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Jim Palmer. We've allowed you to speak, so if you can unmute yourself. And Jim also has a video.
How are we doing getting the video? There we go. Please play.
And I think what's really appalling in this situation is that incredible discrepancy between the pier rates and the mooring rates. And I can also acknowledge that the amount of tidelands that are being utilized by those private recreation or residential piers and the vessels that are attached to those piers is significantly larger than the moorings and the boats associated with those moorings. So there is some real definite inequity going on here.
Thank you. And it looks like Jim Palmer is still unable to unmute himself, so we'll go to Hein Austin.
Mr. Austin?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Can you please show my slide? Thank you. Honorable Commissioner, my name is Hein Austin. This is a satellite view of two identical users on the tidelands. I have notation A, B, and C, but time doesn't allow me to go into details. Notation A shows a dock that pays 1,100 square foot dock that pays 11 cents per square foot per year. If you consider the rest of the dock permit adds $1 million to the value of that home. According to a map online calculator, the highlighted area of the dock occupies 5,400 square feet. The dock pays $600 a year and can park 7 boats for free. 600 divided by 5,400 equals 11 cents per square foot per year for the entire footprint. A big dock like that is allowed to operate as a private marina and could generate as much as $100,000 a year in tax-free rent income with no city oversight. The city says the mooring next to it, the white dot, should be paying $1,600 a year or $8 a square foot. Contrary to staff misunderstanding, moorings are identical to docks. Both are self-installed, self-maintained, long-term boat storage. And finally, docks are multi-user spaces and easy to access, while moorings are single-use spaces and difficult to access, meaning that docks to mooring rate ratios should be the opposite, not as it is today. And that the docks would be, if a dock was paying $8 a square foot, that big dock would be paying $43,000 a year at $8. And if that mooring was paying 11 cents per square foot,
thank you, Mr. Haynes. We have to move on to the next commenter. Thank you. For our next speaker, we have Jennifer Creston.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm fortunate to have been crewing on racing sailboats out of Newport Harbor for over 30 years and appreciate the efforts of the State Lands Commission to help keep Newport Harbor available to all who enjoy being on the water. Sailboat racers in Newport are not comparable to those who compete, say, in the America's Cup with corporate-sponsored boats and a large group of paid support staff. They are individuals who, for the most part, maintain their own moored boats and tackle as economically as they can so they can afford to participate in the sport. Sadly, participation in local regattas had declined considerably over the past few years as costs to maintain and replace sails, haulouts, bottom cleaning, insurance, etc. have increased, while dock owners can rent their space for a profit. I'm concerned that the city's plan to increase mooring permit rates by 500% will be a nail in the coffin for sailboat racers in Newport Harbor. This isn't about fairness. It's about pushing out an unwanted class of boaters, and it comes to the expense of equitable access and to California's tidelands. I respectfully ask the commission to end the discrimination in rates and terms between tideland users in Newport Harbor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker, please.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Peter Kaz, who has a presentation.
Hello, Honorable Commissioners. My name is Peter Chaz. I have a presentation, please.
Yes.
So I just want to let you guys know it's a very emotional time, and we also cut the time to 1 minute. So it's even harder. So I just want to, if you can see, we need to have a dinghy to get to our boats. We cannot walk on the water. It's a tough access. If you can go next picture. We also don't I don't have a parking. I mean, I so far, the last 2 years, I paid like $600 for parking and a citation, and actually got towed once. If you go to the next, our mooring is comparing them with the apple and orange. When there is a lot of high wind, our mooring will start banging to each other, and we need those leaveboard. Actually, I'm not a leaveboard. I wish I was a leaveboard, but we hope that the leaveboard won't go away because they act as a watchdog. If you can go to the next picture, please.
Thank you very much.
And yeah, it's totally different. I mean, the city is comparing these docks with the mooring. And please look at the third-party appraisal that we provide. Please don't follow the city's appraisal. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Khalil Hakema.
Chaley, and thank you for your good work.
Thank you. Please proceed with your comment.
Yes, I'm speaking out today because the city of Newport Beach has shown us by its inequitable dealings over many years that it lacks the requisite integrity to manage the public tidelands fairly. It has regulated discrimination against mooring permit holders, and it seems intent on making us feel like unwelcome second-class boaters. They want to end transferability. The idea that people are profiting when transferring moorings is misinformation, and frankly, it's ridiculous. 20 years ago, the cost to acquire a 40-foot mooring with tackle was about $40,000. That was affordable for people with modest incomes. Today, 20 years later, the cost is about the same. Adjusted for inflation, that's the opposite of anyone profiting from moorings. If you consider the fact that we've paid about $15,000 over the last 20 years to maintain the tackle, the loss is obvious. If we sell our mooring, there is no profit, but we can recoup part of what we paid. If the city is allowed to take away our ability to transfer our mooring, the discrimination will substantially hurt us in our retirement. It's also singling us out, given that the city has always and will always allow transferability of permits for homeowner docks and permits given to marina owners. Please understand that paying a standardized mooring permit application fee wasn't an option when we paid our money for our permits. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Dr. Richard Navarro with a slide presentation.
Hello, good afternoon, and thank you very much for the presentation coming up. So first of all, I want to thank the commission, especially the commission staff for their hard work and really taking our concerns very seriously, and I appreciate the report. I have a lot more comments that I would like to be able to make, but the time is so limited, and so I do hope that you will grant the special meeting in September when we can have a more lengthy conversation. But I just want to provide a little bit more context. So the report relies on the grand jury report from 2007, and it did raise several concerns about profiting from the transfer of moorings. However, there was a working group that is acknowledged in the report that was put together by the city and the Newport Mooring Association to address the concerns of the grand jury report. Now, most of the documentation that is in the report is based on documents prior to this working group. So the working group, as shown here, addresses several of the concerns about profiteering. It addresses the rental of moorings and also includes coastal access. So I really hope that we can get into these more detailed information and help improve the report to make it even more accurate. And finally, let me just say, Lieutenant Governor, you asked the right question about the issue about the docks. And several of my colleagues already raised the issue about how homeowners are profiting from being able to rent those docks. And so that is an issue that we need to take very seriously as well, because that is what is actual profiteering. The profiteering for mooring transfers is conjecture, not factual. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker, please.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Bud Koomans with a slide presentation.
Hi, we're sharing a computer, so I'm not sure if I clicked on my wife's pats, so I don't know if it's me or her. Is Bud Koomans okay?
Yes, please proceed.
Okay, good afternoon. I am Bud Koomans, a permitted live aboard here in Newport Beach Harbor, a retired machinist living on a fixed income. There are those of us on the moorings that have to shower after a hard day at work, and those who shower before work who have the money to live in multi-million dollar homes along the shore. Generally, we shower after work. Mooring holders work for those shower before work homeowners, and they don't pay us enough to have a boat anywhere else than on a mooring at the present rates. I don't begrudge anyone's financial position, good on them. Just don't take away any chance for everyone to enjoy Newport's Harbor. The grandfathered rates remaining for perpetuity that they proposed would be palpable, but we just didn't trust that 2 years from now they wouldn't go back on their word. If I may, the slide shown all had a single boat in a U-shape. However, many have multiple boats on a single pier. There's a single pier paying $463 a year, but has two 55-foot boats, one on each side, and three or four Duffys. We know he's renting the two sides for over $4,000 each a month. This is some of the inequity that is out there on the moorings. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much. Next speaker, please, Katie.
Thank you. And please stay on the line, Bud. We are going to Pat Koomans next. So you should be able to just come right back on unmute. And there is also a slide presentation.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, hi. A lot of scribbling here, changing from 3 minutes down to one. Thank you for your time. I'm Pat Koomans, licensed boat captain for 33 years here, and I live aboard here in Newport Beach. I'm on a 50 mooring. We pay about $1,500 every 2 years for maintenance. Now the city will be paying, wants to pay that for the 700 moorings in the city. I'm surprised that will is going to get passed. The city can rent out our moorings when we are not here, and they collect the money at no cost to them. It's we maintain it and pay for the mooring. They can rent it out to, I think they get $70 a night for our size mooring, and there's plenty available for sale and for rent this way. We pay $2,130 per year and a liveaboard fee that goes up every year with the cost of living or more. And more than half of the allowed 50 liveaboards here are retirees. And this is scary when you're talking about our home and our future for prices. The homeowners, I just want to add, they're allowed to overhang 50% of their width. So when they're paying for a 60-foot dock for a fixed rate of, say, $300 a year approximately, they're allowed to put more than just one.
Thank you, Ms. Koomans. Well, we have to move on to the next speaker.
Half the width. I just want to add they are allowed to go half the width of their boat more.
Okay. Thank you. Katie, next speaker, please.
Thank you. We have Jim Palmer's back again, so we will see if he is unable to mute himself now.
Success, I think. I apologize for the AV issues here.
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you. So much to unpack here. What I'd like to say is thank you for your hard work and staff and commission has done toward this issue. As I read the staff report, its basic findings are that the city of Newport Beach has fallen short of its fiduciary duties for proper administration of the tidelands. To remedy the situation, staff recommends the city should take further action. In my opinion, and that of many others, that is akin to asking the fox to watch the hen house. Page 3 of the report states the city has, quote, decisions that appear to be political in nature. There's a lot more going on here in the city than just administrative shortcomings. I again urge, ask, plead, commission to conduct town hall type meetings to better understand the scale and scope of the city's calculated behavior to restrict tideland access to those of lesser financial means than the city's connected constituents. 6% of mooring holder permit holders do not live in Newport Beach, cannot vote in Newport Beach, and are not represented by the city council. We rely upon the State Lands Commission to represent us on this issue. From this perspective, the staff report fails on its scale and scope. And I thank you for your time today. Much more to unpack.
Thank you very much. Katie, next speaker, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For our final speaker, we have Adam Leverins, who has a presentation as well.
Here I am again. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. As the slide gets called up, I'll start by saying I am available for questions after this. Lieutenant Governor, you posed a number of questions to staff, and I have the benefit of having worked on this stuff for 9 to 12 hours, 6 days a week for the past 2 years. What I have up here, staff talked about that the city's preferred appraisal could be reasonably relied upon and it's sufficient. This is an email from a harbor commissioner dated July 22, 2020, where he says, quote, I've had two long conversations with Jim regarding the 2016 mooring appraisal. The net-net is when we are ready and funded, the appraisal results will look much different than the 2016 numbers. Next slide, please. Note that the RFP for the appraisal wasn't even posted until about 8.5 months later. Next slide, please. Out of those bidders, there were four. How did the harbor commissioner know 8.5 months in advance who the appraiser would be and that the appraisal would look much different than the previous one from 2016? Next slide, please. After the bid was posted, there was about 5-6 weeks for bidders to submit. Do you think the appraiser who knew what the city wanted had an advantage over the other bidders? Next slide, please. The harbor master was involved in the appraisal, yet he owns a mooring in the exclusive yacht club fields and, as a part of his employment agreement, agreed not to participate in anything to do with rates or regulations related to offshore moorings. This appraisal is flawed. Don't fall into the city's trap of endorsing this corrupt appraisal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Katie, are there any more speakers?
There are no additional hands raised.
Okay. I think we probably have some questions, so I'm going to go ahead and kick it off. And I also want to thank those who were impacted by this controversial issue for bringing it to us, because it does raise some really interesting questions about the public trust doctrine and actually what is how we determine whether something is in the interest of the public trust. And I think that the piece around the liveaboards is a very interesting one for us to be thinking about. One of the speakers who identified herself as a liveaboard noted that we are in a housing crisis. If this is an affordable housing option for some individuals, wouldn't we want to be thinking about that in that context as we are doing so much to prevent evictions and to support and even subsidize affordable housing? So I don't know that that's necessarily going to get resolved, but this report is in draft form, and I think it's something for staff to really think about, because the housing crisis does, in my opinion, paint the liveaboard option in a little bit different light. So that's one thing. The second thing is, and I don't think this makes it a conflict of interest for me, but I will say my husband has a pier in San Francisco where he keeps a boat and he pays rent every year. And I was somewhat surprised at how expensive it was. And are we taking into consideration, as part of the administration of the public trust doctrine, that it should not be simply for the most privileged among us, but also for, you know, people in more modest income ranges, that it should not be out of reach for them or so far out of reach to be able to consider to have a boat, particularly when we look historically at boat ownership in California, and it hasn't been something that has been reserved for the most privileged among us, though of course it certainly is a cost. And if all we think about is appraisals for market rate value of renting these spaces, are we missing something when it comes to the public trust of ensuring that boat ownership is not so far out of reach that, in fact, we are undermining our duties to consider the public trust? That's kind of my second thought. And I don't know that these are things that necessarily will be resolved through this process and this report, but I would like to ask staff to think about this in the larger scale of all of the piers and moorings that we have along the coast, but then in particular with this case, that should we have something to say about moorings because they are one would think it would be a lower cost option to have a mooring over a pier, because certainly the convenience of having a pier would be much higher than that of having a mooring. And as someone, I think the last speaker or the one before pointed out, you have water and electricity and all sorts of other amenities that go along with a pier that you don't have with a mooring. I just wanted to kind of share that because in my almost 7 years, 6.5 years of serving on this body, we actually haven't done a deep dive like this. And those are some of the things that I would suggest that staff think about, take into consideration as you finalize this report. But I also do, again, just for the public, want to underscore two things, which is that though we have this bigger responsibility, it is the job of the local jurisdiction to answer the questions for this particular facility. So I hope that they will consider and have considered some of the things that have been presented before us. And it sounds as though to some degree, maybe they have. All right. So with that, commissioners, any other comments or questions?
Just a comment. To echo, I think, what the Lieutenant Governor is asking, I do think, the issue before us is multifaceted and in some ways, to your point, not necessarily perhaps even the commission's, under the commission's purview to actually solve, but I do think that there is a larger policy question posed here at hand that does speak to equitable access and kind of maybe the overlay of the housing element that I think was brought up by several speakers. So I support where the Lieutenant Governor is going with sort of taking this time and opportunity to have a better understanding of sort of the overarching policy as it relates to our responsibility for the public waters piece. I do think it could still continue to be helpful, again, underscoring that we don't have the authority to set the rates, right? We've made that very clear that is within the city's jurisdiction to do so. But I do think that it is within our oversight to make sure, as not just stewards of the public waters on this commission, but also as representatives of the state, writ large, that the city is acting in a way that is not creating a barrier for access. I think that is important. So, if we can continue to sort of get some additional information, I know we keep talking about this apples to oranges comparison when it comes to the costs, but I do think it would be helpful to try to get a better understanding truly of cost and access together, both from the mooring piece, I think, and the peer rates, just as we move forward. So, continuing to have that conversation, the staff to have that conversation with the city, and letting us know as commissioners, sort of, what is their plan moving forward to address some of that, particularly that access piece, I think is going to be important.
And commissioners and chair, I would say first, thank you. We agree. And I think that the whole point of the draft report is to actually elicit additional information from the community and from the mooring holders. We're obviously very open to that. I do think unpacking it is important. There are two very discrete issues. It is mooring rates and their general access, and then the entire different issue about the piers. I think that that's being used in a leverage position, which is the report concludes that the piers are too low and that could actually be a violation of the California Constitution and the granting statute. So I think that staff is in agreement with the general consensus that there are issues with the City of Newport's policies around its residential piers and its rates, and we're going to be continuing to look into that. I know, Lieutenant Governor, the highlight on affordable living is something I just want to touch on because your predecessor in this position actually did agree to waive privilege on an attorney general opinion on liveaboards and a violation and how it violates the public trust doctrine because it privatizes uses of public land and it takes that out of the public. I understand that there's some distinctions in the moorings that make this even more complicated. For example, the mooring holders have highlighted and they're absolutely correct that they buy their own tackle, they place their own tackle, but then the city rents it out if they're not there. That same thing does not happen with a residential pier owner where the city says, hey, you're not using your pier this week, we're going to go ahead and rent it out to somebody else, right? And there are other trespass considerations and issues that are associated.
I'm sorry, Seth, are you saying liveaboards are not allowed?
We are saying that under the Attorney General's, and the current framework of the public trust doctrine, liveaboards are a privatization of public land. Huh. So there are, and we will share this with everybody, and we'll bring this back to the commission as well. So we had
the houseboat issue.
We did in Redwood City.
Yeah, Redwood City. I remember.
Correct, and that was a broader spectrum analysis that the Attorney General's office did weigh in on, and that this commission waived privilege on to share with the larger communities and with the state because it is an open question, and there has been multiple discussions around kind of the affordable living and everything else. And so we understand from a larger perspective that challenge. All We're right. constrained a little bit by the legislation. And I just wanted to also highlight, and I think you've hit on something that is a limitation. You talked about, is market rate really the best metric for this? It's the only legal metric we currently have that's in the statutory frameworks, is that we have to make sure that market rates are being achieved so that it's not a gift of public funds, so it's not a subsidy. But to your point, there may be reasons why the legislature should be looking at subsidizing access in an appropriate location, and that is something I think that we can continue to discuss here in this commission and maybe elevate and make more transparent.
You got that, Matt? Okay. Very good. This item is informational, so there's no vote required, and we are going to go ahead and move on to item 67, which is an update on state legislation relevant to the State Lands Commission. May we please have the presentation, Sherry?
Yes, thank you, Chair Kunalakis and commissioners. I'll just provide a brief overview on legislation that the State Lands Commission staff is following. There's just three-ish bills that I'll highlight. As you probably know, the legislature just reconvened from their month-long summer recess and is in their last few weeks of session before they adjourn on September 12th. So we're in the home stretch, but also the busiest and most chaotic time of the year, and staff will be monitoring any changes or gotten amends that might affect the commission. Most of the bills that we're tracking are on the Assembly or Senate appropriation suspense calendars, and those bills will be considered by those committees next week and then passed with or without amendments to their respective floors or held in committee. The first bill I just wanted to touch on is SB 304 by Senator Aragon. This is a bill relating to the Port of Oakland and Jack London Square in particular, and I know the commissioners have expressed an interest in that, and I'm happy to report that we've reached a consensus with the port and the author's office on the legislation that would set up a framework for the port to bring in more development to reduce the vacancies at Jack London Square and set up the area for success in future years. The bill would lift the trust use restrictions on certain land known as after-acquired land at Jack London Square, which is not historic tide and submerged lands. Those lands typically right next to the water, for 40 years so that the port could issue leases for those spaces that will help activate the area and bring people to that space. And the bill also includes a reporting requirement annually to the commission on the status of those leases and on efforts to activate Jack London Square and a variety of other information. Lastly, it requires the port to approve each non-trust lease and make a series of findings each time it approves those non-trust leases, including that the lease is for fair market value and is designed to help activate and bring people to Jack London Square. The other bill I wanted to highlight is AB 1448 by Assemblymember Hart related to offshore oil and gas leasing. And this bill would impose new conditions on the commission when it considers a lease application for assignment, amendment, modification, extension for infrastructure offshore related to oil and gas development in the Pacific Outer Continental Shelf. That bill is also in suspense. We understand there are some amendments being discussed that would take out the language pertaining to the commission and those additional conditions. So we're monitoring that. I think that has been presented to the author, and we're waiting to hear back about whether they will accept those amendments. The only other bill I wanted to highlight is SB 298 by Senator Caballero related to alternative fuels and ocean-going vessels at California seaports. And that bill would require the Energy Commission, together with the State Lands Commission and a few other agencies, to develop a report by 2030 that looks at the needs of seaports to support ocean-going vessels and using alternative fuels as well as reducing emissions, and then present that report by 2030. Because most of the other bills are either moving ahead or on suspense, I don't have any other updates to report on the legislative front for now.
Okay. Thank you very much. Commissioners, do you have any comments or questions? or actually, first, do we have, Jeff, any hands raised?
We do not have any hands raised for public
comment. Commissioners, question or comments? This item is informational. Thank you so much, Sherry. Item 68 is an informational update on California's 30 by 30 initiative and the California State Lands Commission. May we have the staff presentation, please? Hello, Katie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Commissioners. My name is Katie Robinson Phillip, and I'm a senior environmental scientist on the Climate Adaptation and Special Initiatives team. Today, I'm happy to share an update on the state's 30 by 30 initiative to conserve 30% of the state's lands and waters by 2030. I will also highlight the Commission's involvement. For this presentation, I will introduce the 30 by 30 effort, highlight relevant state guidance, and define the 30 by 30 criteria. And then I will provide an update on recent progress, share how the Commission is contributing to the state's 30 by 30 conservation areas, and outline next steps that staff are taking to further support the effort. Next slide, please. Human behaviors driving climate change, habitat degradation, development, and resource extraction threaten global biodiversity. Nearly 1 million of the Earth's species are at risk of extinction, according to a 2019 intergovernmental report. This includes many California species, such as the California desert tortoise. Recognizing the value that biodiversity serves in supporting environmental, social, economic, and cultural systems, many nations around the world and 9 states within the United States have committed to protecting and restoring biodiversity under the 30 by 30 initiative, a goal to conserve 30% of the world's lands and waters by 2030 for the purposes of protecting biodiversity. Next slide, please. In October 2020, Governor Newsom issued an executive order establishing a goal for the state to conserve 30% of its lands and waters by 2030. In 2023, the state's commitment was signed into law via Senate Bill 337. Next slide, please. In 2022, the governor's administration released Pathways to 30 by 30, a key guiding document that provides a framework for advancing endurable conservation measures that meet 3 key objectives. 1, protecting and restoring biodiversity. 2, expanding access to nature. And 3, mitigating and building resilience to climate change. Next slide, please. Importantly, Pathways to 30 by 30 lays the foundation for how we evaluate areas for 30 by 30 eligibility. Defined as 30 by 30 conservation areas, lands or waters that count towards 30 by 30 are considered durably protected and managed to sustain functional ecosystems and the diversity of life that they support. Durably protected and managed is generally defined as areas under government ownership or control, primarily designated to protect species and habitats, areas under conservation easements, or areas with formalized species and habitat protections. The state primarily uses a 4-level classification system called the GAP code system developed by the U.S. Geological Survey. The system indicates the degree of biodiversity protection a particular area receives. Examples of 30 by 30 conservation areas include lands or waters dedicated to habitat protection, recreational lands and waters, and working lands. Areas that are dedicated to habitat protection typically have the highest levels of protection compared to working lands, which may have lower levels of protections. Next slide, please. The other guiding document for California's 30 by 30 initiative is the Roadmap to Achieving 30 by 30 in California's Coastal Waters, released in June 2025 by the Ocean Protection Council. This document presents a science-based roadmap building on Pathways to 30 by 30 to define conservation in coastal waters and provides criteria for identifying 30 by 30 conservation areas in coastal waters. The roadmap also establishes the state's marine protected areas and the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary as 30 by 30 conservation areas. It is important to note that the roadmap does not fully address the considerations and questions for assessing estuaries and coastal wetlands due to the unique threats that these areas face compared to coastal waters. That is in progress. Next slide, please. California is at the halfway point for 30 by 30. According to the 2025 annual progress update released in July 2025 by the California
Natural Resources Agency, California is on track to meet its goals, having conserved nearly 26.1% of land and 21.9% of coastal waters. Next slide, please. In August 2024, the California Natural Resources Agency reached out to the Commission to review an extensive data set of Commission-managed lands that had been assessed for 30 by 30 eligibility. Staff reviewed over 300 parcels that had been classified as 30 by 30 conservation areas and coordinated with the California Natural Resources Agency to clarify interpretations of durable protections in the context of the Commission's authority and obligations. To date, nearly 200,000 acres of Commission-managed lands have been assessed as contributing towards the state's 30 by 30 goal as 30 by 30 conservation areas. Next slide, please. Most of these lands are unleased school lands near and adjacent to federally protected lands, such as the Bureau of Land Management Wilderness Areas, Death Valley National Park, Joshua Tree National Park, and Inyo National Forest. Staff's review identified 20 active leases in these areas, including leases to public agencies such as California State Parks for the Julia Pfeiffer Burns State Park in Big Sur and to the California Department of Fish and Wildlife for the Fagenslow Ecological Reserve. State lands with active leases can still count as 30 by 30 conservation areas. For example, there are commission-issued leases for transmission cables and railroads and working land activities such as grazing on some 30 by 30 conservation areas. Next slide, please. The state's 30 by 30 initiative seeks to conserve and restore biodiversity, expand access to nature, and mitigate and build resilience to climate change, objectives that strongly align with the Commission's environmental justice policy and efforts to advance climate resilience. Staff continues to support 30 by 30 and are working to assess commission-managed lands to determine whether there are additional candidates for 30 by 30 conservation areas. Staff are also developing an internal process for efficiently tracking and updating the status of 30 by 30 conservation areas when necessary. This step will better enable and inform the Commission's efforts in balancing responsible environmental stewardship with its fiduciary responsibilities. Staff also intend to develop a set of internal criteria to use for assessing lease activities that could be compatible with 30 by 30. And staff will also continue to engage with the state's 30 by 30 partners through discussions and collaborative events, including the recent 30 by 30 partner summit that I had an incredible opportunity to attend in San Diego this past week. Next slide, please. Before I end, I also want to recognize the incredible work of the GIS team, especially Chris Packer and Paige Krinks, who have put so much support into helping process this assessment. Thank you. And that concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Katie. Do we have any public comment on this item?
We do. We have one public comment from Eileen Boken. Eileen, you are welcome to unmute yourself and begin your comments.
Eileen Boken, Coalition for San Francisco Neighborhoods, speaking on behalf of the CSFM. The coalition submitted an official comment on the Ocean Protection Council's 2026 to 2030 draft strategic plan. The coalition's comments included the state's 30 by 30 initiative. The coalition urged OPC to include the waters off San Francisco's Ocean Beach in the state's marine protected areas on a provisional basis, pending the inclusion in the Greater Farallones National Marine Sanctuary as a non-contiguous area. The Greater Farallones National Marine Sanctuary Management Plan review has been completed. The OPC staff has stated that there is a two-year delay in its review and certification. However, at the Greater Farallones National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council meeting, it was stated that the longtime superintendent has taken a voluntary early retirement, and although the management plan review has been submitted to headquarters, they are uncertain what, if any, staff remain to conduct that review. The coalition would urge the State Lands Commission to support the waters off Ocean Beach as an MPA. Thank you.
Very good. Any other comments, Jeff?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we actually do have one more from Pam Hetherington. Pam, you are welcome to unmute yourself and begin your comments.
Ms. Hetherington, please proceed with your comment. Do you think the hand was raised from last time, Jeff?
It was raised recently, but it may have been an accident. Pam, if you would like to comment, please stay on, and we can circle back to you in our second public comment period.
Thank you. Commissioners, any comments or questions on this item? All right, this item is informational. Thank you very much, Katie. Item 69 pertains to an application for a lease for the Ormond Beach Generating Station in Oxnard. There is no staff presentation or action to be taken for this item, but we will hear public comments. Jeff, do we have any public comments for item 69?
We do. Our first public commenter...
And again, this is one that has generated quite a few in the past. How many?
We only have two signed up.
All right, so 2 minutes is fine.
Copy that. Our first commenter is Aurora Ruggiero. Excuse me. Aurora, you are welcome to unmute yourself and comment at this time.
Thank you. And I actually signed up twice. Hello, commissioners. I'm Aurora. I'm a policy advocate with the Central Coast Alliance, United for Sustainable Economy, also known as COS. I'm also an Oxnard resident, and I'm here asking you to reject the lease 4196 for the Ormond Beach Generating Station conduits. For months, Oxnard residents have shared their personal connections to Ormond Beach and the Ormond Beach Power Plant, along with a decades-long efforts to reclaim our coastline by seeing this obsolete plant retire. Broken promises imbue our community with incertitude around the plant's closure and dismantling. With Congress passing H.R. 1 on July 4th, the worry continues. From immigrant rights to environmental justice, both which are very interconnected, our community, like other environmental justice communities across the state, continue to be impacted. As California residents, we put our trust in the commission to protect public access to our coastlines. The state's energy grid reliability concerns, which has been brought up, should not come at the expense of Oxnard residents' ability to safely access Ormond Beach or be subjected to poor air quality during peak energy demand times, which is typically when the power plant turns on. There is a division of authority and responsibility over the power plant among different state agencies, but the commission has a unique opportunity to impede the process of a third extension for the Ormond Beach power plant by rejecting an extension to lease 4196 for the power plant's ocean water conduits. Environmental justice and climate change mitigation policies are dwindling at the federal level. With that, we look to our state leaders, like all of you present today, to be bold, to fight for California residents and uphold California's bold values and goals to justice and the transition to clean energy. Oxnard residents are Californians too. Coastal access, clean energy, and just energy transitions should not be selective. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next speaker, please.
We actually have no other commenters for this item.
Commissioners, do you have any comments or questions? This item is informational, no vote required. Item 70 relates to an assignment of 4 leases for the use of existing offshore oil and gas pipelines associated with the Santa Ynez unit offshore Santa Barbara County. There will be no staff presentation or action to be taken for this item, but we will hear public comments. Jeff, do we have any public comments for item 70?
We have no public comments.
Commissioners, do you have any comments or questions? This item is informational. No vote is required. Ms. Cato, what is our next order of business?
Our next order of business is the second public comment period.
Jeff, do we have anyone who has signed up for the second public comment period? If so, please allow them to have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Pam Hetherington still has her hand raised. Pam, if you would like to try unmuting yourself again to comment, you're welcome to do so. Pam has lowered her hand, so I believe we have no commenters.
Thank you, Jeff.
Oh, excuse me. We have one, actually. Adam Leverins has raised his hand. Adam, please unmute yourself. You're welcome to speak.
Can you hear me again?
Yes, we can.
And I do not know if this is proper. I apologize. I don't have the meeting rules in front of me. During this session, can I not speak about something that was on the agenda?
Correct.
Oh, okay, then I have nothing to say. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much. Commissioners, any comments or questions? All right, Ms. Cato, what is the next order of business?
Thank you, Chair. Our next order of business is our closed session. Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision C7, allows a state body to discuss real property negotiations in closed session, provided that before the closed session, the state body in open session identifies the real properties concerned and the person or persons with whom the negotiator may negotiate. In accordance with this requirement, I announce that the commission will conference in closed session with its real property negotiators regarding the following items. Informational item 69 addresses the application for a lease of the use for the use of existing intake and outfall conduits associated with the Ormond Beach Generating Station located in Oxnard, Ventura County. The negotiating parties are the State Lands Commission and Ormond Beach Power, LLC. Under negotiation are price and terms for lease number PRC 4196. Informational item 70 addresses four applications for assignment of leases governing the use of existing offshore oil and gas pipelines traversing state waters associated with the Santa Ynez unit in federal waters, including the Elwood Pier and two mooring buoys offshore Santa Barbara County. The negotiating parties are the State Lands Commission, ExxonMobil, Pacific Offshore Pipeline Company, and Sable Offshore Corporation. Under negotiation are price and terms. Lease numbers PRC 4977, PRC 5515, PRC 6371, and PRC 7163.
Very good. We will now adjourn into closed session. Will the public please clear the room? Thank you. To order, Ms. Cato, is there anything to report from closed session?
Thank you, Chair. Pursuant to Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision C7, the Commission met in closed session with its real property negotiators regarding the application for the extension of the lease for the use of existing intake and outfall conduits associated with the Ormond Beach Generating Station located in Oxnard, Ventura County. Pursuant to Government Code Section 11126C7, regarding applications for the assignment of four leases governing the use of existing offshore oil and gas pipelines traversing state waters associated with the Santa Ynez unit in federal waters, the Elwood Pier and two mooring buoys offshore Santa Barbara County under negotiation.
That concludes the open session. Thank you, everyone.